This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Downtown Task Force has only three more meetings before its first report is due August 31st. Alderman Kimberly Bray says downtown Bloomington is a center for economic development.
Where can we encourage economic development? If we have a city that is vibrant and robust, then we all benefit from those centers.
In our series of interviews with newly elected Town of Normal Council members and Bloomington aldermen, the Ward 9 alderman talks about her early work on the Downtown Task Force. The IPR Politics Roundtable talks about whether a special legislative session called by the governor will get Illinois closer to a budget. And John Norton talks with the leader of the country rock Joe Stamm Band playing around Central Illinois this week. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 19th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Two new aldermen are serving on the Bloomington City Council, Ward 1's Jamie Mathey, and from Ward 9, Kimberly Bray, who is filling the seat previously held by Jim Fruin. Bray is a State Farm employee working as an in-house attorney for 31 years, and she's a 15-year resident of Ward 9. During her campaign, she focused on bringing a fiscally conservative approach to city budget decisions, urged balance in assessing competing resource demands, and she said she'd work to identify areas for economic growth. Bray, who is serving on the Downtown Task Force, says she's looking forward to finding and encouraging pockets of economic growth.
I'm very excited about this appointment to the Downtown Task Force. As you know, we had our first meeting on Monday. It was Tuesday, actually. Monday was City Council. Tuesday.
You have a busy schedule.
The days sometimes blend together, but it's all good work and great people, I have to say. And Amelia Burgess is chairing that committee. So we're starting off with studying where we've been and the work that the citizens and staff have put together up to this point, so we can distill that out and actually plug that into our initiative. So how that connects then with my desire to bring about economic growth is to find those pockets within our city, and particularly focusing on our downtown, and say, where can we encourage economic development? If we have a city that is vibrant and robust, then we all benefit from those centers. And frankly, we become a go-to location for all of Central Illinois.
So a strong downtown benefits Ward 9.
It sure does.
The first deadline for the task force is August 31st. What do you think the task force, talked about some of this, has to accomplish before then? What needs to be in that report?
Priorities. We'll be setting priorities. And Tom DeBriner did a great job really briefing us on some of the, I guess I'll call it the options that have been early identified. And actually, we have a heat map, if you like that term, that's a term that's been used, that kind of sets up for us the things that are high priority and maybe lower effort, if you will. And those are the kinds of things that we'd like to jump on rather quickly and elevate, maybe by filling in some particulars as well as some action plans. Now, whether or not, how far along we'll be by our first report date, I'm unclear.
Where does, how much heat is behind trying to find an anchor? And that anchor often has been discussed as a hotel for downtown Bloomington.
We've not fleshed that issue out yet. I think that we know that we already have some significant anchors in our downtown. We have our Center for Performing Arts, as well as our McLean County History Museum. And then, of course, we have the Coliseum as just a pure entertainment and actually community place for gathering. So we have that. I think more likely we'll just look at things that make the downtown cohesive.
Is the warehouse district, is that a lost cause? Is there still hope there to do something in that area?
Oh, yes. It's not a lost cause. That's definitely something that...
A lot of the buildings are gone, though.
Exactly. Which is of interest because we're only limited by our own imaginations. So that's an exciting prospect, if you will. While the warehouse district might not be directly taken on by our downtown task force, we've not yet
defined the parameters.
Defined all of our parameters. It is something that is certainly an interesting prospect for the future of Bloomington.
You talked about one of the anchors, the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. In that area, the city has recently purchased some parking lots, with the eye to developing those parking lots, not leaving them as surface parking. Is there enough parking in downtown?
I think there is. When I ask folks who reside in the downtown, and I just anecdotally, when I've spoken to people about their ability to get parking and my own ability to get parking, because I'm there quite frequently, it seems that we are in a good situation in regards to parking. I understand there may need to be some updates. And certainly as we add infrastructure or as we add features to our downtown, we may need to reevaluate parking needs. But for now, I think we're where we need to be.
Kim Bray is Ward 9 Alderman and part of a series of Sound Ideas interviews with newly elected city officials. I'm Mike McCurdy. You landed on council at the same time the debate intensified about competing resources, specifically between the city's core and outlying subdivisions. The catalyst was a sewer oversizing project to serve development north of the Grove. Where are you on this?
Well, we're waiting to hear back. There's been some questions asked in regards to where the Grove is in, the timeline of their project. And are there any obligations that, are currently outstanding that we need to address? It's my understanding that the fashioning of the Grove agreement gives us, the city, a continual opportunity to check in on that development and to make decisions as it goes along. So we're waiting right now to hear where we are in that time frame.
And to be clear, though, the sewer oversizing project wouldn't affect the Grove as it is defined today. We're talking about 13,000 acres north of the Grove with homes that have not been built yet. Would you be supportive of an amendment striking this budget expenditure for the sewer oversizing project and reallocating those funds to the city's core?
Well, I like to take a look at it. I'm not against that. At the same time, I am and sensitive to agreements that we've made and whether those agreements were where we are in the timeline of those agreements. So we are waiting to hear back from staff and from the developer with some additional information about, a snapshot in time. Understood that some of this goes well into the future, and maybe there's an amendment or a new agreement to be made about some future development. But
Your Ward 9 predecessor painted it as a ward versus ward battle. Do you think it is?
In my short time on the council, which is
sworn in May 1st.
Yeah, I've attended three meetings now. I don't see any battles, but I am interested in finding out more about it and making a fully informed and reasonable decision on behalf of my Ward 9 constituents.
Where are you on the comp plan in terms of, putting resources towards what they call regenerative and preservation neighborhoods?
I'm supportive of that, and as I've spoken with Ward 9 constituents, they were supportive. And as I campaigned and knocked on those doors and had that opportunity for interactions, and it kind of goes like this: folks that like to live in a more suburban area understand they're not in the downtown area of the city, and that's okay by them. But at the same time, they want to be a satellite around a vibrant core. And so they've been very supportive of maintaining that core that we call our downtown district.
And it sounds like you're not quite ready to make a decision on striking this budget expenditure for the sewer oversizing until all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted. You want to make sure it's been fully examined.
Yes, that would be a correct characterization.
Right. The council has approved a transportation commission replacing the Staff Traffic Advisory Commission. You voted for this new commission. Why?
as I campaigned and talked with folks about various issues about traffic safety, I heard time and again that constituents would just like the opportunity to voice their opinions, to have a forum or a place to go to weigh in and say about, say, I guess, weigh in and say comments about traffic in their community, comments about safety concerns they have.
Or bring new issues to light.
And things that may go beyond what a technical study might show. And so I think that as I read through the proposal of the Traffic Commission, and we worked through making amendments to the initial proposal, I just felt like that met the need that I heard loud and clear from my constituents.
So how do you envision this Transportation Commission working with elected officials and city staff?
Well, that's the devil's in the details, right? So, and everyone has acknowledged that this will be a work in progress, that we'll all have to work together and see how this plays out. But there is some information within the ordinance as passed that sets up the structure for the commission, and does expect that staff would study and make recommendations, and then the commission would take a look at that and then make recommendations to the city council.
Kimberly Bray was sworn in as Ward 9 Alderman last month. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Let's talk about cooperation between Bloomington and Normal. You favored the dissolution of the Metrozone tax sharing agreement and favored future cooperation between the two communities. Let's listen to what you had to say at a League of Women Voters GLT candidate forum back in March.
It's time for another agreement and another purpose. Since the creation of the Metrozone, we've developed the Bloomington Comprehensive Plan and the BN Advantage. These are excellent vehicles for collaboration. We can use these plans and shared visions for our future to help shape the next deal. And this time, let's have a termination clause. Setting expectations and opening dialogue are essential.
And that's you from March, a GLT League of Women Voters candidate forum. How do you move forward from this point, and what is that next deal, do you think?
Well, in order to move forward, I think it's important that we have communication between the town of Normal and the city of Bloomington to identify some common goals. And so through those kinds of discussions and those kinds of communications, perhaps we can find where that next deal might be. Perhaps it's a sports complex. Perhaps it's a medical office complex. It could be some kind of other entertainment a venue. Not known. I think that as we have conversations and talk about the needs of our citizens, that will guide our path.
Could it be a municipal-wide, city-wide tax sharing agreement?
Perhaps. I won't count that out at this juncture, but I'll have to certainly study what those numbers might look like and see what that deal could look like.
Do you think part of the issue with the Metrozone agreement was the fact that there was no way to get out of it cleanly? You talked about an exit strategy or termination clause.
Exactly. The question that was posed there for me was, would I have voted to terminate as the city council did? And I answered yes. It was time to terminate because it was an agreement without a termination clause, and I don't think that's good business.
Some aldermen and council members are meeting. A tax sharing agreement, we've heard, is on the table. Some people have talked about this. Are you meeting or talking with any of your counterparts in Normal? And has this come up?
Not at this time.
Okay. Five groups are now calling for some sort of citizen-led oversight board for the Bloomington Police. Where are you in this issue?
Well, I'm meeting with the groups you've mentioned, met with several stakeholder groups. Of course, I've met with the police chief, and as well as I've studied the various iterations of the proposed ordinance. So at this juncture, I'm looking for, I'm hearing about the various pain points, if you will, the obstacles to good relationships in the community and the police, and looking for solutions that match those obstacles or those pain points. And as I study the most current iteration, which was handed to me today, I'm looking to see if there's a match between those pain points and those solutions that have been proposed. And as I guess the best honed the solutions are, the more likely I would be in favor of it.
One of those pain points might be with the contract the city has with the police union. Is what you've seen going to work with represented staff that protect the community?
At this juncture, I don't have that level of information.
What do you think about what David Sage had to say, that he doesn't see a need for a review board in light of the other mechanisms for people to file a complaint with the police?
Well, I like the idea that we use the mechanisms that are in place and exhaust those opportunities before we create something new. So some of the questions I've had with these stakeholder groups is, have we exercised the process that's currently in place? For instance, the complaint process. We know that the complaint numbers are very low. So why is that if we're hearing anecdotally that there are many complaints?
So when you've met with these groups, what kind of stories did you hear? I mean, are you buying what you're hearing?
Well, I'm hearing things about reluctance to interact with the police.
Problematic.
Which is problematic. And as a member of the city council and as a person who believes that our police force and its resources should be available to all citizens, it's of concern to me when there is a group that indicates that they don't wish to involve the police in matters in which the police should be involved. So we need to identify what are those obstacles to involvement and relationship. I'm quite encouraged by the Jefferson House and the opening that we'll have tomorrow. I'm hoping that will start more dialogue and start to develop relationship that will encourage all members of the community to interact with the police force as intended.
200 cities in America have these civilian review boards, so certainly Bloomington can find a way to make it work.
If needed, then Bloomington should find whatever we need to make things work. I'm just waiting to see what the current proposal will do for us and how it addresses the issues that we have in our town. So then we'll have a committee of the whole meeting on Monday, and we'll walk through where we are with the current iteration and see how it matches with the identified pain points and obstacles
sure.
that exist in our community.
Could be if both sides are unhappy, or if both sides are happy, then you've reached the you've reached the middle ground, right?
Could be, yeah. Could be.
All right, Kimberly Bray, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Mike.
Kimberly Bray is Ward 9 alderman, elected in April and sworn in last month. She'll attend her fourth meeting as an alderman tonight as the council meets as a committee of the whole to consider a citizen police review board. Find this interview, along with interviews with Ward 1 alderman Jamie Mathey and Town of Normal council member Kimberly Cummings, at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
For GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner has called special sessions of the state legislature for every day until the end of the fiscal year. The Illinois Politics Roundtable tackles that issue today with IPR's Sean Crawford moderating the panel that includes Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Chicago Daily Law Bulletin reporter Andrew Maloney, and IPR's Brian Mackey. Mackey speculates why Governor Rauner called the sessions.
That's a good question, because obviously Illinois has gone without a budget for nearly 2 years, and he has resisted calling special sessions up to now. He just says the time is urgent, he says the Democrats have been ignoring his agenda for the past couple of years, and the time has come that they should take it up. I think that's worth mentioning here. It is new that the governor has called a special session, or actually he's called 10 special sessions, one a day for the last 10 days of June, the last 10 days of the fiscal year. But what's not new is that he's asking legislators basically the same thing he has all along. He says, here's my policy agenda, my economic agenda, my political agenda. I'd like you to pass that. And then we can talk about balancing the state budget as part of that deal. This is not, just to deal with the budget. It's still dealing with some of these things that, the governor once called his turnaround agenda.
the discrepancy, I guess, between now and previous times is you have this Republican budget that's been introduced. The governor has said that he's willing to sign it. And so he's kind of putting his name on something where, in contrast, for instance, when we were talking about the grand bargain over in the Senate, he was sort of very hands off. He would say, well, you know, I'm encouraged by the discussion.
Publicly hands off.
Right. Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. Publicly hands off. But now he's come out and said this. You know, I will sign this if it's approved, though. We don't know exactly how much traction that'll get or exactly what'll happen next week. But that is one other thing to take into consideration.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but is it the first time that the governor has sort of indicated a specific tax plan that he would support, the number of years? I believe it's a 4-year income tax hike. It would expire after that time. Is that the first time we've heard that from him?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly made vague statements about taxes. You know, he would agree to new revenue if there were, these agenda items passed that he wanted. He did have some specific tax proposals in campaign documents, but after he was elected, it's been a much more vague statement. Of course, he's also been sending letters to voters and his supporters saying, you deserve a budget with no tax hikes. So he has had a little bit of this, you know, saying one thing to one audience, another thing to another audience throughout this process. But yes, Sean, your greater point is right. I think this is the first time we can say he has put his, you know, word behind a potential tax hikes. Of course, it is worth mentioning, I think, that this Republican budget plan does not actually include a tax hike bill. They introduced every aspect of this thing that they want, you know, term limits on executive branch office holders and legislative leaders, worker changes to the workers' compensation system, budget bills, but they did not introduce a tax increase bill. They apparently still don't want their names associated with that in the legislative filing system, and they're counting on an already passed, I believe, the Senate Democratic tax increase bill.
Charlie, is this movement, I guess, then?
I think in a sense it is. From my perspective, and this is going to sound cynical, I think it's a phony move by the governor, a public relations stunt, reflecting the fact that he's starting to feel some pressure, and maybe we do have to finally get a budget, and we just can't wait until we finally starve the beast to shrink the size of government. And I say it's phony, because if you were serious about it, you wouldn't trot out, here's the compromise, and it's between my left hand and my right hand, and here are my Republican minions who say they'll vote for it, but, oh, no, we don't include tax increases. That's the Democrats. And I'll sign it, but it's got to be exactly as it is. There's no room for adjustment. And to get a true compromise, what you need is for the four legislative leaders and the governor to come together, work through all the different issues, and reach an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats, and then bring that agreement in legislative form to the floor of the Senate and the House and have it voted on. Once you have an agreement, you don't need a special session. If you don't have a bipartisan agreement, a special session is a waste of time. But it looks good. It looks like, oh, the governor's getting involved. Yeah, he's out there fighting for us, which is a bunch of malarkey.
Well, what are the Democrats saying about this?
Well, the House Speaker Madigan basically says, you know, this seems like more of the same. You know, we're willing to work cooperatively with the governor, which has basically been his talking point for 2 years now. But he says we won't accede to the governor's policy demands that, in the Democratic view, would hurt people in the middle class. So some of the changes the governor wants to workers' compensation, other things like that. You know, they say we've done our versions of trying to meet the governor's sort of topic ideas. The Democrats passed their own version of changes to the workers' compensation. They say that they're, you know, trying to meet him. That's their version of compromise. You know, to Charlie's point about, you know, calling something a compromise when it's a one party, here's our thing, please vote on it. Yeah, that is definitely not what the dictionary, I think, would say compromise is. Democrats have been guilty of that as well this year in particular. We've seen, and this is gets to Sean's question about what has been the Democratic reaction. The Senate president said, hey, we've already passed the governor's own budget plan. Look, here's the governor's budget document. It had a big $4-point-something billion hole for a grand bargain. We passed the grand bargain, and we passed, you know, we balanced the budget using the numbers he proposed in his document. Now, of course, you know, the governor says, well, I'm not signing off on that. The Republicans did not vote for that. But this is sort of the negotiating posture. Look, we are trying to compromise. Everybody wants to show that they're the ones who are trying to work with the other side when both parties still seem to be far apart on some of this stuff.
To get back to the Republicans not introducing a tax bill, I think it just illuminates again just how toxic that idea is, or they believe that idea is for their party and for their base. They're not even willing to introduce the legislation. They want to alter the Senate version of it.
And Andy, that gets back to the point that I made earlier about Governor Rauner emailing or mailing, I should say, sending print mail pieces to supporters saying, you deserve a balanced budget with no tax hikes. A lot of Democrats see that and get suspicious. Well, look, he's already campaigning on the fact that there were no tax hikes. Is he really sincere about supporting this, or is this just more, messaging, trying to create the narrative that he is working cooperatively?
Brian Mackey is IPR's Statehouse reporter. He was joined on the Illinois Politics Roundtable by Chicago Daily Law Bulletin reporter Andrew Maloney, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and moderator Sean Crawford. It's Sound Ideas. Coming up, John Norton catches you up on the country rock career of the leader of the Joe Stamm Band. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Craftsmanship and voltage merge in a new body of work from one of the Twin Cities' most respected artists. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The University Galleries in Uptown Normal presents Illuminance 2015-17, works by artist Dennis French. Gallery director Barry Blinderman was eager to showcase French's new work, sculptures that incorporate light, which harken back to a first series of similar works, which were created in the late 80s and early 90s. After wrapping up a big on-site commission for a client that took about a year and a half of Dennis French's time, the artist was looking for something new to create. And then a light bulb went on. Literally.
Because I had done lighting in the past and really enjoyed it, and because of the new technology available, LEDs, in other words, I decided to start pursuing that idea, and I started making some prototypes, sketching out ideas, working with some prototypes, trying to figure out what would work best for what I wanted to do as lenses, meaning the material that would actually take the light, diffuse it, make it into the lamp that it is. And that was always kind of the issue in the past. If you're not a glass blower and you don't want to use a traditional lampshade, you have to come up with these creative ideas on how to diffuse that light. And so the first one aren't in this group. They're all gone. They sold. But they were a little more traditional in that they used a lot of wood. Mm-hmm. And there was a pair that took a long time to build, and there was not a right angle in them, and I called them the evil twins. They're in the catalog. You can look at them later. You can see them. But, yeah, they're not in this show. But the first of the ones that were using this, what is called Soji paper, and it's sold online by a mom-and-pop business up in Madison, Wisconsin called eSoji. It's a traditional Soji paper that's been laminated, and so it's highly durable.
You say you like working with light. Why? What is it about light?
Well, light has a lot of metaphors. I'd rather be in the light than the dark most of the time anyway. Now, light, like I said, I've done Illuminance before, and light, the way that we can, as human beings, can work with light to give an ambience, a certain kind of ambience to our environment. That's mainly how I look at these, is an ambient light. You're not going to sit down at the drafting table with one of these. They're an ambient light that is also, I think, sculpture. And I'll leave that definition up to Barry, but I do believe that most of these could be construed as functional sculpture.
Well, Barry, tell me why you wanted to show these new works by Dennis here at the University Galleries.
Dennis had called me to make a studio visit, and I saw really virtually most of these, if not all, plus the earlier ones that he'd been talking about. I was just really impressed, and I said, let's think about a small show. And I thought it would be an excellent summer show. I do see them as sculptures that incorporate light. I think there's only one piece, and that's the flight that's hanging from the ceiling, that even anywhere near resembles a lighting fixture that you would find somewhere else.
You know, it's funny because I looked at it and it made me think of some of the early attempts at flying machines that people made.
You got it. I mean, that's...
I had Orville and Wilbur in mind a little bit there.
But even that one, really, I mean, I kind of challenge somebody to find a light fixture that looks like that. So this tension between the functional and the aesthetic is really on an even keel. You can think of them in both ways. In fact, I really like the architectural aspects. Really looks like a tall building. These have almost a transportation, old stagecoach metaphor going on. And the spiral relates to Vladimir Tatlin's constructivist tower. And the blue, though, that blue-purple light is just so intense and affecting in both these pieces. So I like how also at night we can leave them on and people can see some of the reflections in here.
So Dennis, you said that technology, changes in technology, have impacted how you're proceeding with these sculptures.
That's right.
Tell me how the technology changed, how it was you were able to create.
Well, the ones I made in 89 through 91, I think, most of them utilized 12-volt technology, but back then you had these real heavy-duty transformers for that, and your light, your source, was anything you could find that was 12-volt. And usually what I found were 12-volt lights from automobiles, but they're incandescent. You know, the dome lights, for instance, they have a bayonet connection. It's called a bayonet connection. And they run very hot. And
you certainly couldn't use paper with that.
No, not at all. And they can't come very close to anything because they're so hot. LED technology is just so much different. I'm using, for the most part, LED ribbons, which are composed of what are called SMDs on a conductive strip.
What somebody could use actually as under cabinet lighting
in the
kitchen.
That's exactly how, you know, it's being used for the most part. Architects are making great use of it now. You're seeing LED light everywhere you go, hidden. It's so ambient sometimes you don't even know it's there, but it's there. And it's very easy to hide. It's very easy to run. You just have to know a little bit about circuitry.
Barry, does art like this, these are things we can have in our lives that can not only be beautiful, but they can be useful. How much does art influence retail design in something like lamps?
Oh, a lot. I think that art in general influences design, graphic design, product design, advertising, and I think by the same token, advertising and product design and other commercial areas of design affect art. It's a continuum. I'd say it's a continuous aesthetic spectrum that goes back and forth. I think that people are looking at creative work everywhere, and when someone who's working with lighting for industrial lighting sees something like this, it's like, wow, you know, like I didn't think about using that paper before. This is great. And I'm sure when Dennis walks around and looks at, you must be looking at other lighting fixtures just to get an idea of the playing field. You know, what can I do if it's different? What's great, as I mentioned before, though, is just how different these are from what I've seen in the art and industry or industrial lighting places that mostly I've seen in New York and Chicago, that these are very distinctive. It's a great symmetry that we're able to show this second series, kind of like the Illuminance Redux, and after showing the first set of these so long ago in 89, it's like 28 years since we've done a one-person Dennis French show. And here we are again.
When people buy your works, Dennis, how do you hope people live with your works?
Well, I'll tell you a good example of that. This is the second show I've had in 2 months. The other one was in Decatur at the Madden Art Center, and it was a big one. There's a few of these lamps that were in the Decatur show, and there was also the rest of the Biedermeier clocks that I hadn't sold yet. Okay, so there were 25, 26 pieces in this very big space. It was a beautiful show. And I sold some work out of there. One of them, it had a leaded glass kind of pyramidal lens on it on top, lampshade. And the gentleman and his wife lived in Decatur on Millikan Place, that little place where some of those Frank Lloyd Wright style buildings are. And they had an arts and crafts home that was just beautiful. They were major collectors, and they wanted me to bring it over after the day that we closed the show down, crate it up, took it over, put it where it was supposed to be, where they wanted it, and they were just ecstatic. It looked like it had been there forever. So that's the kind of client that you hope buys your work, that they're really going to be engaged with it. It's going into an environment in which it looks like it was meant to be there. They were happy. They were so happy when I left. I was happy.
So when people come in to view this show, what do you hope they take away?
I just hope people take away the fact that good art can be found. You know, it can have a place in home. I think seeing these kind of functional sculptures should help them view it in a different perspective and say, this is something I could have in my home.
Well, I think people that see this show will be drawn like moths to flame. And I think it's going to be one of our most accessible shows. And I'm just getting illuminated just standing here.
You couldn't resist it, could you?
No.
My man.
That's artist Dennis French and University Galleries director Barry Blinderman. Illuminance is currently up and continues through the summer. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See photos from the exhibit at our website, wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Once upon a time, there were some eager gardeners who wanted to make something grow.
I planted roses.
I'm growing heirloom tomatoes.
Purple coneflower for me.
And they each ran into problems along the way.
Ew, black spots.
Wilt, so much wilt.
Is this supposed to be brown?
But I helped them out with that, and now their gardens really grow. My name is Murph. I can help you too. Send in your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Thanks to generous GLT listeners, we're on our way to wrapping up our fiscal year on budget. Your contribution before the fiscal year ends June 30 will help make sure we can continue to pay for the news and entertainment you rely on. Contribute now at WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Joe Stamm is the leader of the country rock band, the Joe Stamm Band. He has a number of Central Illinois appearances this week, including a Wednesday stop at the Fifth Quarter in East Peoria. After starring as a quarterback at Metamora High School, Stamm continued his football career at Northern Illinois University after initially committing to Illinois State. But Stamm tells GLT's John Norton an arm injury changed his destiny.
It was actually my senior year of high school. I signed my national letter of intent in a sling. So ISU got the better deal out of this, by the way. I fought through my first year. I ended up having, it was supposed to be this revolutionary new surgery that would fix everything, and it just didn't. So I ended up having nagging problems, got through a year there as a redshirt, and then had another shoulder surgery. And it just never got better. And by the time I was a sophomore, the trainers and the doctors just kind of told me, hey, you need to set this aside. I wasn't ever going to be able to throw competitively again. Oh, so
that must have been hard for you.
It was.
I mean, geez, you're an athlete. You've done this all your life, ever since you're probably 5, 6 years old, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly a crisis of identity. And plus, you're 19 years old at the time and in a new town, and that was a crunch in terms of existentially speaking, for the time.
So, but you made a left-hand turn.
I did.
You went into music,
yeah,
professionally.
I did. And what I ended up doing, much to my dad's chagrin, is after a few years, because they honored my scholarship. I could have graduated from NIU for free.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, again, as a young kid and just thinking you need to change and do different things, I ended up transferring after 3 years to a small school in Indiana. And in order to graduate there, my last semester, I had to take a music course. And so I took Intro to Guitar and just instantly started writing. I tell people, kind of tongue-in-cheek, I always say that I had to figure out another way for people to pay attention to me.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. That was down the road. I said, you know, you're a football guy,
yeah,
and now you're on stage playing music,
right,
and in some way,
a little bit in
the stage has been...
Attention hog, yeah.
Well, that's something, maybe a need that you have.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. We're talking with Joe Stamm. He's from Metamora. He's got, yeah, a great band called the Joe Stamm Band. Mm-hmm. And you've got an EP out.
Yeah.
And let's get into that a little bit.
Sure.
You open the EP with, you know, Loud and Proud. You're from Central Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to breathe that autumn air. Comes around this time of year in Central Illinois. I'm a Woodford County boy, but I'm stuck down in Laredo, Porter Town, Slash Hole.
Most people who write music or in music, you know, certainly where they're from, you know, informs what they're doing, especially when you're relatively new.
Right.
How so for you in Central Illinois and Metamora?
Yeah, I think a sense of place and a sense of home has always been very important to me. I've spent most of my life, all of my life in the Midwest, most of my life in Central Illinois, outside of some time, like I said, in DeKalb, Illinois, and then in Indiana, and then I lived in the suburbs for Chicago for a few years, but returned back here in 2009 and have been here ever since. At least this is where I operate out of. And I guess those fields and fence rows and those creek bottoms is kind of where I grew up, and that imagery and that nostalgia of the small town that I grew up in. And even, you know, where I live now, out in the middle of nowhere, kind of close to the Illinois River, north of Metamora, it's just such an important sense of place for me, and it's such an important element of my identity. And I think everybody's initial reaction, and I get this all the time, well, are you going to move to Nashville? And I would just like to avoid that as much as possible. It's just because... I don't know. I'd lose my sense of place, I think, down there. And so much of my writing, of course, stems from the imagery that I'm used to, the images that I grew up around, the images that I continue to surround myself with on a daily basis. So that sense of place has always been important to me.
I want to sink my feet into some Illinois clay, walk along the cornfield in the cool of the day, get a dog and chase a rat. Up a tree, get back to what makes me feel like me. I find a Midwest girl that can handle the cold and doesn't leave
with. Were you a writer in high school as well?
No, I wasn't, but I was always a couple of things. I was always a good writer, like in college. I was actually a biblical literature major and a history major prior to that, and that is all writing. It's all research and writing. So I did become adept at expressing myself in writing, albeit in very different form from songwriting. But I think where that connection takes place is when I first started really intentionally listening to lyrics. It was guys like a guy named Chris Knight. I'm not sure if you've heard
of him. Oh, I've talked to Chris, yeah.
Yeah, great. That had
been
a great interview.
Oh, he's a fantastic songwriter, yeah, and just a fun interview.
Yeah. We went down and saw a few shows of his in Texas last month just to have some time off. Just such a cool guy to talk to. Talked for at length after a couple shows. But him, and huge influence on me, Chris Christopherson. And it was all about lyrics. Melody is obviously important, but where I get excited, and where I always did, even before I started writing, before I started playing guitar, lyrics, and songs, and stories. And I guess that's what really gets me excited and jazzed about music. And I think, yeah, that's where you see that crossover from writing essays and research papers to being able to tell my own stories.
Joe Stamm is who we're talking to, the Joe Stamm Band. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Another song on the EP. There's only three songs on the EP,
right,
so you make it easy on this,
right,
one. One Night Stands.
Sure.
It's a really interesting song lyrically, if I'm hearing this right, because it's sort of a love story. You're telling someone,
sorry I never called, don't take it.
The line you use is, "Sorry I never called, but you could never be." What are you getting at?
I think
it sounds like a real diss.
Yeah, well, and I think it's honest.
Okay.
You know, I think when you think of one-night stands, you think of just general debauchery or you know, a guy tomcatting around town or a player of sorts. Or when one-night stands are talked about in songs, they're usually talked about in that capacity, either celebrating being out in the town and getting drunk and taking somebody home. I didn't think that they'd been quite nuanced in this way, and this way to me is the very honest way, because one night stands for people that have some sort of conscience, at least for somebody who is raised in a very Mennonite Baptist conservative upbringing, a one night stand isn't something you're proud of. It's something you do in a altered state of mind, and you have to live with. And I think it was something I guess I wanted to communicate from that perspective. This didn't happen because I'm trying to fill my ego or there's some kind of conquest, so to speak, that is taking place. Because I think especially that whole kind of frat boy mentality has never been one of my mentalities. And it's not a lot of people's mentalities, and it's not reality. So you're never gone.
Does biblical literature start to find its way into your music?
I think it's the same thing we were talking about with landscapes and everything. I think everything seeps into your music. I think more than anything, just my upbringing in that conservative evangelical world influences me, and my reactions to that world in present day, I think. And as I've grown into my current reactions towards that world, all that stuff is captured in different songs that I've written throughout. And I think One Night Stands is certainly one of those.
Well, you're hinting at something here that I want to flesh out.
Sure.
Are you in conflict with the way you grew up and the way you're going professionally right now?
No, but I guess it depends on what you mean by it depends on what you mean. I think there's always a conflict for most people with how they're raised, but and sorting through that and then determining kind of your own worldview and what you really believe. There was many, many years of conflict in terms of how I've come to live my life and what the things I've come to appreciate and the things I've come to be okay with versus the angst and guilt and just expectations of the world that I grew up in. I think that'll always be an ongoing saga until the day I pass on. But I'm at peace with it more than I ever have been.
Joe Stamm is who we're talking to, the Joe Stamm Band. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Let's do one more song before we end up. And you just released a brand new single.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this going to be on an upcoming album?
It will be. And I think originally when I set out with this project, it was supposed to be a full-length album. And I still think it may. But I think what I might do is I might stretch it out a bit. We released the EP, and now we're ready to start releasing singles. And I think when you release a full album, one thing that happens is you stick it in and you kind of key on two or three songs, and then the rest kind of fades to the background music. And they become skipped pretty easily after one or two listens. And what I want to do is I want to put stuff out there very intentionally that people can digest for a little bit. So I think I'm going to string out some singles for a while. And then once I get to where yeah, this could be one full album, well, then I'll package it and put it on the merchandise table. But I think in the meantime, I'm going to start just plugging some songs out and letting people nibble at it for a while.
All right. Well, you literally brought a burned copy from your home computer.
I did.
And what's the name of the song?
The song is called Crow Creek.
Grew up swimming on Crow Creek. It ran calm and cool and clean. When the rain would fall in the early spring.
And it's a creek that's about a half mile from my house as the crow flies. And back in 2013, we had a deluge of rain. And it was in April. It was one of those 100-year floods that seem to be happening a lot more often these days. But in any case, it was the first one in a while. And the Illinois River flooded. I live close to the Illinois River. Crow Creek feeds right into it. It's a big creek that feeds right into the Illinois River close to my house. And everything backed up. At the time, I had a day job as well. And I had to figure out a way to get home. It took me twice as long. It was pouring down rain. The creeks were flooded over bridges. Roads were closed. And I knew there was nothing I was going to be able to do that night. So I stopped. I grabbed a bottle of whiskey on my way home. And I said, I'm going to write a song. And the song I wrote ends up being Crow Creek. And what the song touches on is several things. The physical nature of brown water in the spring, and when the creeks flood and the river floods and that river's brown with silt, and the brown water in terms of whiskey, and the impact that both of those things, when the levels of consumption are too high, can drag your life away.
That's Joe Stamm of the Joe Stamm Band. Thanks for stopping into the GLT studio. It's nice to meet you, and I love your music. Yeah, man, this is great.
I appreciate that.
Metamora native Joe Stamm speaking with GLT's John Norton. Stamm plays an acoustic set at the Fifth Quarter in East Peoria this Wednesday. On Friday, the Joe Stamm Band performs at the Metamora Old Settlers Day. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the complete show podcast and all the individual interviews today at our website, WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.